Welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte, a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, check me out at siftedaswheat.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. You can also find me on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or follow me on Twitter at Heartline Pod. So let's get going on this journey of the heart. Most of us want life to make sense. Why? Because it gives us a sense of control. It makes life feel more predictable and safe. But what about when life gets tough? What happens when our story doesn't have a happy ending, and we can't make sense of life, God, or the world around us? We'll be talking about that today with best-selling author Cecil Murphy. He's written a new book called Making Sense When Life Doesn't: The Secrets of Thriving in Tough Times. Cecil has written or co-written more than 125 books, including the best-selling 90 Minutes in Heaven with Don Piper and Gifted Hands, The Ben Carson Story with Dr. Ben Carson. His books have sold in the millions and have brought hope and encouragement to countless people around the world. Cecil, welcome to Heartline.
Hey, thank you so much for having me as your guest.
Sure. Tell us what motivated you to write this book. What did you want people to learn?
Well, you know, it really started one day when I was in the doctor's office, and I looked across, and there was a man. They told him to stand on one foot and then the other for balance, and the guy was waving and hardly, and he was staggering, trying to stand up. And as I looked at that, I thought, you know, that's the way life is. We're constantly trying to balance. Some of us do it fairly well, and some of us look like we're flapping our wings. And it made me really do some serious thinking about the whole idea. And also, it seems to me that we believe that as Christians, life ought to go smoothly if we're following Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And when something disrupts it, it's like, uh-oh, what's wrong with my life?
Absolutely. We think that the story's supposed to always have a happy ending.
Right.
So what do you think, you know, when people say, why is this happening to me? Why am I in this mess? Why now?
Well, first, I would say don't ask why. Even if you know the answer, it doesn't change anything. Suppose you said, okay, God, why am I in this mess? God said, okay, I've got 18 answers for you. Here are 18 reasons. You know what? You still are the same thing.
Yeah.
But if you say to God, God, what is going on in me that makes me need this? And I really believe that. It comes out of my need and God's love. What does God want to teach me, if you want to ask it that way? I truly believe that every time we have what we call a disruption in our lives, is an opportunity to grow and to be more faithful to Jesus Christ.
Mm. You know, I work with a lot of people who struggle with anxiety disorders, and one of the things I frequently hear them say is, I was waiting for this. You know, whenever tragedy or problems come, you know, it's like they're waiting for the shoe to drop. What do you think that's about for folks?
Well, I think there's something, I wouldn't say it that way. The way I would say it is I have been preparing for this. 5 years ago, my house burned down.
Wow.
And I lost my son-in-law in the fire. And I was standing there waiting for the fire trucks to come. And I heard myself say, I've been preparing for this. And I didn't mean that I expected a tragedy, wanted a tragedy. I simply meant that God had been working in my life, blips and upsets and failures, call them whatever you want, so that when this came, I was ready to deal with it. I could handle it. And I think that if we could look at it that way, is to say that, to think of God doing these things to make us stronger and more ready for the next step, then it could be therapeutic and positive. But if all you can do is grumble because every time you have an upset, it's like, well, God, you interfere with my plans and my programs.
So you're saying that he's the same God in a trial I might have had earlier in my life, and through those trials, it's like my faith muscles get stronger. I sense God's present with me so that when maybe the bigger trials come, I'm ready to handle those. I've learned things along the journey.
Exactly. How I came with that is my father died, and on the day of his funeral, my older brother died.
Oh, my gosh.
And I have... We were originally seven siblings, so that was the first one to die. And the rest of my siblings were all, who's going to tell Mom? Who's going to tell Mom? My mother was 80 years old, and I said, how do you think she got to be 80 years old? She has handled hardships and heartbreak. She can handle it. So they said, okay, you go tell her. Well, I did. And, you know, she said, okay. And she went into her bedroom. She cried a while and so on, came back, and she was okay. She handled it better than the rest of us.
Okay, so you say we strive for balance in life, and yet we never attain it. What's that about?
Well, do you? Come on. Think of your own life.
I'm just griping about that this morning to my sister-in-law.
Okay, you know, we always want everything on a nice, even balance, but it doesn't come down. In fact, I think if we do really balance, we become complacent. I think part of the adventure of life is that there's always something new to learn. And so we do get thrown off balance, and in trying to regain our balance, it gives us the opportunity to say, wait a minute, you know, maybe if I could do this or that. I have a friend named Skip, whom I love dearly, and he's always getting himself into one time mess after another, overscheduling. And I was with him in a car, and he said to his wife, well, we just get past this, I'll be okay. And she laughed, and she said, Skip, as soon as you get past this, you'll have another mess.
Right.
And I thought, yeah, that's the way life works.
It's like we're never satisfied. It's either one thing or another.
Yeah, and I think part of that is what keeps us growing, if we're willing to grow, or we could sit down and grumble about the mess we have in our lives.
Right. How do we avoid wasting a crisis?
Well, two basic ways to handle a crisis. One is, oh, isn't this terrible? God must be against me. What have I done? All those awful things. Now, when we have a crisis, I do think we need to seek God and ask God what's going on. But more important, I think, is how can I grow from this? The way I say it is, I can't choose the crisis, but I can choose what I learn through the crisis.
Or my response to the crisis.
Yeah, that's right. Sure. And, you know, that's the way life is. I call it the IB, the inevitable bump. We think everything's going to be very smooth in life, and then that IB comes along, and we're thrown off again. And instead of grumbling or asking if God's against us, maybe that bump is a corrective measure for us.
Or trying to figure out, like you said, what God's trying to teach us, how he's trying to grow us up in dependence on himself.
Yeah, right. See, if we could work it all out, we wouldn't need to ask God's help anyway.
Right, exactly. And so God's allowing certain things, whether it's a trial, a tragedy, a crisis in our lives, is partly about what he's doing in and through us through that, partly about growing us up in dependence on himself, and partly about us reaching a point of maturity spiritually.
Yeah, you know, think of anybody you know really respect for a person who's really lived a consistent Christian life, and ask them, have you had any problems in life? And you'll probably discover they have probably had more than you have. And I think that's how wisdom comes to us, is we go through these hard times, we learn the lessons, we move on, and we're preparing for the next one. But doing it joyfully. We're not doing it grumbling and saying, oh, God, you got it in for me. We're saying, hey, as much as I hate these bad things that happen, I'm going to grow and I'm going to learn from this.
Yeah, that's so powerful, Cecil, right there. It's how can we learn from it? And I think we don't, especially when we're younger, we don't sit there and we're going through something bad and we're so self-absorbed about that we don't think about what we're learning and how we can use that later on in our lives, or even apply it, like you said, to the next trial or test that comes along our way.
Yeah, you know, I was reading, for several months, I was reading in USA Today when things were really, really at the worst in unemployment, And there was they did a whole series of articles about people who changed their entire direction when they lost their jobs. And these people were saying, well, I never would have made this change if I hadn't been downsized. Well, that's an example of what I'm talking about. Sometimes we have to have these hardships, these disruptions, to make us ask ourselves, what do I really want? What does God want in my life?
Yeah, exactly. So sometimes the bad things can actually switch our course for the good, if we're open to that.
I think most of the really bad things in our lives, if we look back later, much later, we can usually say, you know what? That was a powerful learning experience. That was one of the best periods of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Not
yeah.
always, but I think that's often the case.
Or an opportunity for something else, or for God to use it in a certain way in our lives, to redirect us even.
Yeah.
So that gets to, you know, this idea of passion. How do we follow our passion or rediscover it?
Well, most of us start with some kind of passion, desire for something. And I think we get caught up with what I call the tribal goals, you know, making a living, getting educated. And nothing wrong with those, because we certainly need them. But the problem is that in trying to establish ourselves and make ourselves in our careers, we follow the easy way. Billy Joseph Campbell once said, most people follow the prudent right-handed path, and when they get to the end of it there's a brick wall. But he said the others follow the left-handed path. They never know where they're going, but it's the one that's the most enjoyable, you know, the road less traveled.
Well, I think, you know, we are born, and as we grow, we have passions, and sometimes those things get put on the shelf because of what you call those tribal goals. Like, I get married, I have a mortgage, I have children, and so we kind of box our passions up and stick them on the shelf, and we don't run after them because of all this other stuff. And so at some point, when we hit a wall, that's a good place to reassess our life and say, hey, you know, I'm an individual. God created me with gifts and passions. I need to start walking in some of that. I need to, especially after like a death or a divorce. Those are times,
right.
Critical times, change times in our lives where we have to have this journey of self-discovery, where we have to look at what our passions are in order to reinvest ourselves in life.
Yeah, you know, I knew when I was very young that I wanted to write, and two or three times through my early 30s, I thought, yeah, you know, I need to do that. And I just kind of lost that passion. And when I was 38 years old, the passion, I began to listen to that passion again. And, you know, been a full-time writer for better than 25 years. But I had to rekindle. I had to re-look at that instead of focusing on normal pathway to success. I was a successful pastor. Things were going well. But it wasn't what I really, truly wanted.
So sometimes our passions then are buried, and we have to just light the spark again. Something lights the spark. God lights the spark. A situation, opportunity lights the spark for us to walk in that then.
Absolutely. I agree with you. You've said it well.
What do you mean by these words? I won't focus on small failures. I'll accept them as tiny steps toward big success.
Okay. We try something and it doesn't work, and we think, oh, well, it's a failure. And you know, you can look at it that way, or you can say, you know, I tried something and it didn't work. I can learn from this. I don't have to be sidetracked. Instead of thinking it was a terrible failure, maybe it's a small a step towards success. Let me give you an example. Before I became a believer, I started smoking when I was about 14 or 15. After I became a believer at age 21, nobody ever talked to me about it. I just felt that smoking was incompatible with being a believer because it was destroying my body, which was God's temple. So I tried to quit. I tried all kinds of methods, and none of them worked. Now, at first I was thinking, oh, this is awful, I'll never quit. And then one day I thought, wait a minute, I'm getting closer to it. Each time I find something, it doesn't work, but I keep trying. And one day, this was like 3-4 months later, one day I knew I could do it, and I just quit. That was it.
Yeah, I think you got a huge point here. I teach my clients this. I think we look at victory as, okay, I'm going to quit smoking and I'm going to do it tomorrow and I'm never going to pick up another cigarette. I work with a lot of eating disorder clients too. And any time that they don't binge and purge. You know, maybe if they do it twice for a week, that's a small victory.
That's
and guess
right.
what? If you can do it twice, you can repeat it. And so you build on those successes. And what happens is you're going to like how that feels a little bit better. And so you're going to want to do it more.
Yeah, that's all I was really trying to say is even those failures aren't really failures unless we want them to be.
Mm-hmm. It's how we define victory. You know, and ultimately, I think we need to look at victory as a person. Victory is the person of the Lord Jesus Christ. And when my focus is on him, where is it not? Well, it's not on myself. So I think that, you know, these things that we look like, that look like failures to us, we've got to keep looking at the big picture that God has. Because success doesn't happen overnight. I have to have perseverance. And God may be trying to work out certain things in my character, like perseverance and diligence and intentionality and deliberate effort. And then that will open the doorway to, you know, bigger success. Okay, so how do folks adapt to a changing world?
Well, I don't know exactly how to tell people to adapt because that's an individual thing. But I think if we recognize that we don't stand still, that we have to keep moving forward, and the life, our life changes, but the world changes. The values aren't the same today that they were culturally, aren't the same today as they were 20 years ago. I went back to Northern Illinois, where I taught many years ago in the public schools. I hardly recognized anything anymore. Well, that's kind of the way it is. Or 20 years ago, who ever thought about cell phones and email?
Right.
And part of growing is to say, you know what? This is what is. It may not be what I want. It may not be where I want to go, but this is what is. And I think we have to say that, you know, God is with us no matter how dark the way looks for us.
Right, and he is the constant. He's one thing that doesn't change, so that's one good piece of news for all of us.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing, readers, I think we tend to want certainty, and we want to know what to do next. God, just show me and I'll do it.
Right.
Well, sometimes we need to do it, and then God will show us we've done the right thing. I think we kind of want the easy life, not kind of, I think we want the easy life, and I think the Christian experience is not the easy life. The Christian experience is one of challenge and uncertainty.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we need life to be safe and predictable in order for us to feel safe. And what we don't realize is if we have Christ, we already are safe. We can't be more secure. We may not have a feelings experience about that moment by moment, but that's the truth.
Yes.
You have a chapter on rethinking fitness. Why do we need to rethink that topic?
This whole idea of fitness, I think we tend to think of it as losing weight or making strong kind of bodies so that we're energized and all that kind of thing. That's fine. Those are benefits. What I think we really need to think of is that what's really at the core of this, and if it's done right, I think the core of it is my body belongs to Jesus Christ. If my body belongs to Jesus Christ and I take care of it, I'm honoring God. And I think we, even in the church, we've gotten caught up with the results of not being overweight or not, you know, not having high blood pressure. And of course, we want to stop those things, but we do it without realizing that part of this issue is taking care of God's holy temple.
Do you believe that the search, no matter what the issue, is as important as achieving the goal? What do we learn through the search?
Oh, that's where all the lessons come in. It's not finally getting there and saying, at last I've made it. It's the struggles and setbacks and deterrence we have along the way. That's where the joy and the excitement comes, whether we like it or not. See, again, we keep wanting the easy way. We want God to just kind of make everything smooth and so on. And what we don't want, but what I think God wants us to realize is we need uncertainty, disillusionment, a sense of futility. I went through a period of about 18 months when God absolutely did not speak to me. I just said, God turned out the lights. It wasn't that I didn't believe God. I did. It wasn't that I was in sin, because I certainly confessed. But about halfway through that, I thought, you know what? I'm in the darkness on divine assignment. We don't even know what these things may be, but I don't think that searching is as important as the finding. I think it's more important. It's the pathway that leads to the goal that is the real exciting part of our Christian experience.
Yeah, as you're talking about that, I'm thinking about Job. You know, he was on this search. I mean, he had lost everything that was precious to him, and he certainly was upset with God, confused. He had all kinds of emotions going on with him, but he wrestled with God. He told God about that, and in that search, I think he really connected and found God.
Yeah, and some of those chapters, there's a little bit of pride there, mm-hmm. Like, I didn't deserve this, and God, what are you doing? And I think part of Job was, not only was Job a righteous man, but there were some lessons Job needed to learn as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and we tend to forget that. We tend to think about poor old suffering Job and all he went through. Yeah, that's right. But he also learned.
Yeah.
On the journey.
And I think that the important thing about the search is that it connects us. It connects us to others. It connects us to the heart of God. No matter what the issue is in our quest, we find the heart of God if we're really diligent about looking. And Job did have an open heart. You know, so did David. And that search is where we learn and grow. So it is hugely important.
Oh, yes.
You also stress the need for accountability in the book. Why is that so important?
Well, I think that we never know for sure if we're going in the right direction. We may think we are, but it's so helpful to have somebody else who's there to lay it out on. I have my best friend. We never thought about it as accountability until recently, but he's been my best friend for 30 years. We meet every week for an hour to 2 hours, and all we do is just open our hearts to each other. I have learned so much because he loves me, but he's also able to be somewhat objective.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes he's able to say to me in very loving ways, you know what, you're wrong, and I need that. And I could say the same thing to him. And that's what I think accountability is. It's not only do they need to encourage us, but they need to look at us objectively, and they can correct our thinking and correct our blind spots.
Right. And so in the tough times, we need that for people to be able to be objective in our life, especially if we struggle with anger or unforgiveness or things like that.
Yeah, and you know what? I think sometimes we don't even know. I never knew I was angry. I'm serious. Not that I thought I never got angry. It's just I was not aware when I was angry. And that's one of the most marvelous things that my friend David did for me, is he was able to say to me, you know what, you really are angry. And I remember the first time I said, no, I'm not. He said, yeah, you are. And he was able to show me that I really was angry.
Wow. It's awesome to have a person like that in your life. We need that.
In some way, we need somebody for accountability. And the other thing I would say is, I don't think the spouse is the person to be your accountability partner. See, I believe God's purpose in marriage is a man and woman become one.
Mm-hmm.
I think you need an outside person, a person who isn't already in love with you and can look at you objectively. My wife can look at me pretty objectively in many ways, but I still feel I need somebody outside of my marriage
sure.
to help me straighten out.
Explain your statement, what we don't receive in childhood, we spend our lives seeking, often on an unconscious level. That's powerful.
Well, I came from a very dysfunctional family. I honestly am convinced that neither one of my parents loved me. That's a given. And nothing ever changed to make me feel differently. And so what I realized, for many years, I was just searching to be loved, to be accepted, to be wanted. And my wife was the first person that I know of who absolutely loved me without any kind of condition. She gave me that kind of acceptance and love that I had never had before. And I was already a Christian, and I understood it intellectually, but emotionally, she was the first one to give it to me. And that, I realized that that's one of the major issues in my life. It's something I've been searching for all my life, was to just to be loved.
And you weren't convinced of God's love at that point? Or it's like,
you know, it's like this. I intellectually, theologically, absolutely, I knew God loved me. But on an emotional level, I have to say that I really wasn't always convinced. And part of it was because of not feeling loved as a child. I'm really convinced that whether we like it or not, I think old Freud was right, that we do confuse God and our human father.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so when I wanted something from God, it was like I had to treat him the way I treat my earthly father. I begged and pleaded and got mad and all that kind of... And I never had a... It took me a lot of years to have a healthy relationship with my Heavenly Father and to realize that God truly loved me. Yeah. Now, I'm talking on the emotional level now.
Sure, yeah. Okay, so what's wrong with saying, I just want to be happy? That's what we all say. That's the mantra of our generation here. You deserve it. You need
it
to be happy.
Time.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think it's the wrong point. It's that's the objective. I think if you start looking for happiness, it's pretty selfish in a lot of ways. There's nothing wrong with wanting to be happy, but it means that if we stop pursuing happiness and focus on what we have and appreciate it, I think that becomes happy. About 15 years ago, I started doing this. I don't remember even how I started, but when I wake up in the morning, I lie there and just think of 10 to 15 things for which I'm honestly grateful and thankful to God. I'm a runner. I go out running early in the morning, and again, I do that again, and at night. And you know, just to appreciate and value what I have.
Just by doing what you said, sitting in bed, think about 10 things that you're grateful for and do that on a daily basis, because once every 6 months isn't probably going to cut it. But if we're intentional about it, then we'll start noticing that we cultivate an attitude of gratefulness for that which we do have. Cecil, we're out of time. I wish we had more. I just appreciate you being with us today. And thank you so much for your time. Blessings and all you put your hands to, Cecil.
Thank you so much, Rita.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining me today. If you have a question or comment, or you'd like to be a guest on Heartline, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at siftedaswheat.com, on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or Twitter at Heartline Pod. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.